Dr. Kilgour.
I'm Evelyn Andino Rosa.
Have a great day.
WBAI New York. Degrees at 5 p.m. You are tuned to listener-supported commercial-free community radio WBAI at 99.5 FM on the internet at WBAI.org. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide weekday afternoons. Thank you so very much for staying with us, and please do visit us on that website. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Doug Henwood and Behind the News.
Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for July 24, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And I've got two segments lined up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Mark Linder, who's a professor of law at the University of Iowa, about a couple of things. He has been on the show quite a few times to talk about issues of work time, overtime, and the absence of pee breaks on the job. He co-wrote a book a couple of years ago called Void Where Prohibited, and now he's got a follow-up out recently called Void Where Prohibited Revisited. So we'll talk to you about that, but also about plans in Congress to revise our overtime regulations and about the issue of work time in general. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Chris Carlson, who is in town to talk about the organization Critical Mass, the militant Andy Carr pro-bicycle group. He will be at Blue Stockings Bookstore tonight talking about that and talking about a film, We Are Traffic. This is all part of the New York City Bike Summer celebration, and we'll talk to him about traffic and bicycles and also anarchist politics and some other things like that too, probably. And we'll be joined in a moment by Mark Linder, but just first a couple of words. I want to apologize for not being my usual hyper-prepared self tonight. I'm doing final corrections to my book, After the New Economy, which should go to press tomorrow if all goes well. So I've been very preoccupied doing that and not paying as much attention as I should to the outside world, but all that will be behind me as of tomorrow. But a couple of bits of economic news. First of all, the weekly jobless claims numbers, the numbers that the Labor Department releases every Thursday morning on the number of people filing for the first time for unemployment insurance and also the number of people continuing to draw unemployment insurance benefit, which is the best contemporary indicator we've got of the state of the job market. These numbers are available very quickly. These are last week's numbers, so and they're very sensitive and often very timely and very offer a almost near real-time insight to the state of the economy. Those initial jobless claims numbers took an unexpected dropped this week to their lowest level since February, and they have been very, very high, staying above the 400,000 level that most analysts consider recessionary or near recessionary. Fell to 386,000 this for the week ending July 19. And the number of people continuing to draw unemployment claims also fell slightly. Still 3.6 million, quite a high number, but it's been it's off by about 100,000 in the last few weeks. So there is some improvement there. A warning, though, the Labor Department says these numbers are clouded by the auto plants' regular summer shutdowns. Most economic numbers are adjusted. The raw numbers are adjusted for normal seasonal variations. So you can see what's happening with the underlying trend, and it's very hard to adjust over the summer months in these numbers because of the staggered and unpredictable nature of auto plant shutdowns as they retool for the new model year. So, good sign, but not yet conclusive. And economy.com, or the Dismal Scientist website, has a report out today on the regional state of the U.S., regional variations in the U.S. economy. And they report that labor markets in the South and West have been stable now for the past year, while the Northeast and the Midwest continue to suffer in the first half of the year. The recession is really not over, at least in terms of the job market for the Northeast and the Midwest. And when you add in industrial production to the job picture, then that conclusively says that the Northeast and Midwest have not yet exited recession, even though the official arbiters of recession, the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research, said last week that the recession ended in November 2001. It may have if you look at national averages, but if you look at the regional picture, especially our region and the Midwest, it ain't happened yet. And economy.com also surmises that the South and the West are going to lead the country out of recession if that's indeed what's happening. And they made a special point of emphasizing the defense-intensive economies of Southern California and the Southwest, which are enjoying the military buildup that not many of the rest of us are enjoying too much. And then finally, speaking of war, the oil market has not yet really come back the way it was supposed to have after the end of the war in Iraq, or the end of the first phase of the war in Iraq. Everyone suspected that peace would bring about a quick resumption of Iraqi oil production and a decline in oil prices, which are normally a great economic stimulus, but that hasn't happened. Oil prices are still above $30 a barrel rather than the 25 or so that most analysts had expected at the end of the war. So this is acting as a considerable drag on economic recovery. So, enough of that. We're now joined by Mark Linder, who is a professor of law at the University of Iowa and a prolific, very prolific author for a variety of subjects, author of the classic anti-Samuelson book from many years ago, but now most recently several books, Moments of the Elements of Profit, History of Work Time Struggles in the United States, Void Where Prohibited, which was published about 5 years ago, about the struggle over bathroom breaks and OSHA's non-enforcement of the right to stop the line and go pee for a second. And now he's got a follow-up to that, Void Where Prohibited, Revisited, Mark Linder of the University of Iowa. I also want to start by asking him what's going on with the fight over overtime reform. The Bush administration and the Republicans in Congress are rather eager to redefine that, and I haven't been following it as closely as I should have, so let's start by asking Mark Linder what's up with that. Welcome to WBAI, Mark Linder.
Hi, thanks.
So what's up with this these overtime revisions that the Congress administration are working on?
The overtime regulations, basically, that are up for grabs, deal with overtime for office workers, so-called white-collar workers. We've had these regulations basically as they are now since 1938. And one of the central problems with the regulations is that there is a so-called salary level test associated with the regulations, which means that anyone earning, any white-collar worker earning under a certain floor cannot be treated as a so-called exempt or really excluded worker. And so it's unlawful for an employer to treat a worker with a salary below a certain level as not entitled to overtime. Unfortunately, the level has not been increased since 1975. In other words, depending on which test you use, there are two different tests, only people earning under $155 a week or people earning under $250 a week are off limits as far as employers' efforts to deprive them of overtime, which means, of course, that nobody is off limits. The regulation really should be invalid. I think it's possible you get a judge to invalidate it because it hasn't been updated for 28 years. Now, the Bush administration is doing two things now in its proposals. One, it's proposed to increase that salary level that we just talked about. And secondly, and we'll get into this in a little bit more detail, to revise the so-called duties tests, which define what an excluded white-collar worker is. Now, as I said, the current levels are $155 and $250, and the Bush administration is proposing to raise this level, inadequate though it be, to $425 a week. However, it should be kept in mind that the Clinton administration had 8 long years within which to raise that level. This is purely regulatory. You don't need Congress's permission to do it. The power has been delegated to the Department of Labor, and at any time, the Department of Labor could have done that during the Clinton administration. It never did. 10 years ago, I interviewed the Wage and Hour Administrator, Maria Echaveste, and asked her, why don't you just put it into the Federal Register, say I intend to raise the level to whatever, X hundred dollars, you got anything to say about it, go ahead and say it. If not, I'm going ahead and I'm going to issue these final rules. And her response was literally, yes, I could do that, but the McDonald's of the world wouldn't like it. And I said, I didn't know the McDonald's of the world were your constituents, and that was the end of that conversation. So basically, the Clinton administration, by its inaction, has created so much pent-up demand for, as it were, for an increase in the salary level that the Bush administration can now go ahead and raise that level as it must, and then hide behind this increase in order to fool around with the duties tests to make them even easier for employers to meet. Now, you know, this is all well and good, this fiddling around with the duties test, but I think what isn't being discussed at all in this debate, and by the way, supposedly the Bush administration has received 80,000 written comments on the proposals, which will take them into next year to process. Maybe some people at the Department of Labor will be getting overtime to read all those comments. In any case, what hasn't been focused on is that these white-collar regulations have made no sense since the day they were issued in 1938. It's not just an invention of the Bush administration or the Reagan administration or whatever administration. They have been irrational and senseless since 1938. There is no reason why white-collar workers should be treated differently than blue-collar workers. Why should a blue-collar worker who makes $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year receive overtime while some poor schlemiel of a white-collar worker who makes $20,000 a year or $25,000 a year, why should that worker be required by his or her employer to work 50, 60 hours a week without overtime, without any additional pay whatsoever? this is really what this is all about, and this is what nobody is discussing. And I think we really need to approach this from a different point of view. The duties tests are totally senseless. It makes no difference whatsoever whether I'm an administrative employee or whatever as to whether I should be getting overtime or not. And one fundamental problem with these regulations is that Congress in 1938 gave the Department of Labor absolutely no guidance whatsoever as to what it meant by so-called bona fide executive, administrative, or professional employees. Nothing. There is absolutely nothing in the statute. There is absolutely nothing in the debates in Congress. There's absolutely nothing in the hearings. There's nothing in any congressional report that sheds any light whatsoever on what Congress meant by bona fide executive, administrative, or professional employee. By rights, really, the Secretary of Labor or the Wage and Hour Administrator should turn to Congress and say, I'm sorry, you better define what you mean by this, because you've given us absolutely no guidance, and I have no idea what it is that you mean.
Well, I'm afraid this Congress might come up with something kind of abominable.
Well, you're right about that.
But let's turn to the broader question of the fight over the length of the workday and also the devotion of employees within that workday is so fundamental to the nature of capitalism. Yet it's not really talked about very much, as much as it should be. Why? And I've just been reading this highly theoretical book by an Italian whose name now escapes me that Verso just published about work hours. He's devising a whole lot of fancy theoretical reasons that don't exactly persuade me. Why is it in employers' interests to maximize the length of the workday wherever possible?
Okay. By way of getting at your question, first of all, we should also always keep in mind in these discussions that these laws refer only to the amount of money that you're going to get for these additional hours beyond the so-called normal or basic work week, or in some cases work day. There is no protection that a normal run-of-the-mill adult worker has against the compulsion to work those hours. So although the Fair Labor Standards Act provision is called a maximum hours law, it is not a maximum hours law. An employer can work you 168 hours a week. There's nothing unlawful about it, apart from certain categories of workers like airplane pilots who might cause mass catastrophes if they became fatigued. There's nothing to prevent the employer from doing that other than the prerequisite that you pay time and a half. And I think this the aversion that legislatures have, much more so, by the way, in the United States than in Europe, the aversion that legislatures have to interfering with employers' power and control over the workday has been virtually universal in the United States. And I think this touches on a core area of a contestation of power at the workplace, and employers are dead set against having anyone tell them how many hours a day they can work or when those hours should be.
But the French have experimented with trying to increase employment by shortening the work week, for example.
That was one of the main purposes of the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1938, but to do it indirectly through this so-called penalty premium.
Well, the idea then would be to discourage overtime work because it was more expensive for the employer.
Yes.
But
of course it's also more expensive the other way around, and it's a premium to the worker, and therefore you're giving the worker an incentive to work it while you're penalizing the employer, so it may lead to results you didn't want.
But why would they may not get a similar number of work hours if they hire more employees? They could have 150 workers instead of 100 working shorter hours, and you end up with the same aggregate number of hours. Employers seem to prefer to working their existing employees harder and longer than to hiring new ones. Do you understand why that is?
Today and in recent decades, that proclivity has in large part been driven by benefits, because benefits are not calibrated according to the number of hours you work, and therefore it's a fixed cost. And sure, go ahead and make this person work 60 hours a week. It's cheaper than, to the extent that you're paying any kind of significant benefits, it's much cheaper than to hire a second worker and pay another set of benefits, full benefits, to that second person. Which is something I don't think Congress foresaw in 1938, although it's been brought to Congress's attention many, many times since then.
Now, our unions and other labor activists have not really made working time into a central demand. And in fact, like the auto industry, auto unions have actually shied away from it because a lot of the workers like the overtime. But why has it not been a priority of the American labor movement to focus attention on the length of the workday, the work week, and the work year?
I think the big turning point was World War II. Up until then, for various reasons, one, because of course the work day and the work week were much longer and they were much more intrusive, but secondly, during the 1930s, because there was huge unemployment, unions were much more in favor of limiting the work week. I mean, we came fairly close to having a 30-hour work week by law in the 1930s. I mean, the Senate actually passed a 30-hour work week law in 1932-33, before the New Deal took over. But things really turned around quickly during World War II when the hours got longer and overtime was paid, and people were working 48 hours, sometimes longer than 48 hours, and people were racking up a lot of overtime, people who could remember the Depression. And that snowballed, and the main focus then turned on who's going to get the overtime. I mean, you have more grievances filed over unfair distribution of overtime, meaning I'm not getting enough, than you do over mandatory overtime. And it's been, to the extent that unions have been willing to take on the issue of mandatory overtime, they've gotten a great deal of resistance from employers, and they don't always, that's an understatement, they don't always have unified or uniform support from the members, because there, as you mentioned, there are many workers who may be short-sighted because they're young and they don't understand that they're going to screw up their bodies permanently, or because they've got certain lifestyle expenses that they've taken on, whether it's a house or whatever else, and they need to make a certain amount of money to sustain that standard of living. And they're not interested in limiting overtime, and therefore the union is not in a position to present the united front that it would really need to take on that struggle, which employers, again, they're dead set against giving control over to anybody, let alone unions.
Well, it also makes for a very stressed and alienated and depoliticized society when people are working incredibly long hours with very short vacations. I'm speaking with Mark Linder, who is a professor of labor law at the University of Iowa and author, most recently, of Void Where Prohibited Revisited. And let's turn to the issue of the right to pee on the job. I had you on the show about 5 years ago when Void Where Prohibited first came out. And I guess that book stirred a bit of a controversy, so you have now a follow-up to it.
Yeah, just to remind people, believe it or not, up until 1998, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, had on the books a regulation and had that on the books since its beginning in 1971 that all employers have to provide a certain number of toilets per certain number of workers. However, OSHA also took the position that employers were under no obligation actually ever to let workers use those toilets, and workers didn't have a right to use those toilets, an argument that only a lawyer could love. And at that time, I, probably like all the rest of you, I was flabbergasted by this, and out of this came that book. And there was regulatory lobbying done by the United Food and Commercial Workers And finally, in 1998, OSHA was embarrassed into issuing an interpretation of that regulation that said, no, provide means that you actually let people use it, and you have to let workers go to the bathroom when they need to go to the bathroom. So this new book that I've recently put out is a study 5 years after the regulation first went into effect of the extent to which OSHA has been enforcing the regulation. And one thing that you have to keep in mind here is, I'm sure everyone's in suspense, there have been, in the past 5 years, there have been only something like 25 citations issued by federal and state OSHA to employers for denying workers access to go to the bathroom. In most instances, the monetary penalty has either been zero. This includes these 25 citations, or relatively nominal amounts. Only in one case has an OSHA imposed a significant monetary penalty on an employer. That was here in Iowa against a animal slaughter plant where supervisor wouldn't let two women go to the bathroom, and they both defecated in their pants. And to add to the foreman's pleasure, he then went around telling everyone else in the plant that these two women had defecated in their pants. Well, OSHA made the company pay $36,000 in fines and $25,000 to a governmental charity. Exactly how they did that is kind of a mystery. But anyway, so $61,000, although it's a very, very large corporation and it's not going to bankrupt the corporation, still there may be some deterrence in that. But the run-of-the-mill penalty is well under a few hundred dollars, and it's not going to scare anyone off. One of the problems here is that OSHA does no independent investigations in this area. The only way it's ever going to find out the way it operates that someone's been denied access is through complaints. Now, when you've got 90% of the private sector workforce not in unions, you're dealing with a problem, because many, many workers realistically believe that if they go and file a complaint over something like this, one way or the other, it'll get back to the employer and they'll be out of a job, even though it's illegal to fire you. It'll be a while, maybe years, before OSHA can get you your job back. And in the meantime, you've got to make a living somewhere and you may be blacklisted. And it's very difficult to get employees to complain over this or other matters as far as that's concerned. And OSHA, when it goes in to do a general run-of-the-mill inspection, a programmed, scheduled inspection, does not, never asks employees, by the way, do they let you go to the bathroom? That's just not one of the questions they'd ever ask. And so one of the reasons that you've got so few citations is that OSHA is totally reliant on people coming forward with these complaints.
Now, maybe some listeners are listening and saying, okay, this is silly. You know, this is a minor discomfort. People can wait till lunch if they have to pee, and it's no big deal. It's maybe a pretext to make some pee-pee jokes, but that's, you know, it's really pretty small in the hierarchy of workplace outrages. It's not as trivial as it might sound, though, is it?
In that vein, I would say that no male should be a supervisor before his prostate has started to enlarge and before he has to get up a couple of times a night to go to the bathroom. It is a problem for millions and millions of people who are not in any way ill. They're normal. People would be surprised what the norm is for going to the bathroom. And going to the bathroom three times a day during an 8-hour or 9-hour total span of a work day is just not enough for most people. And it it not only is a problem of dignity and you know, having to pee in your pants or having to spend a lot of money actually on adult diapers, at least the good ones, it's totally unnecessary. Now, I mean, and you do have to, in addition, there are physical, biological, physiological problems that can result from holding it in, and there are also health problems that can result from trying to deal with the problem by not drinking. I did a study together with a urogynecologist here of school teachers that revealed that the teachers who drank nothing because they couldn't get to go to the bathroom had an incidence of urinary tract infections more than double that of the ones who did drink. So they're, you know, using various tactics to deal with this problem can also boomerang. It is a significant problem, and it's not, by the way, just in unorganized chicken processing plants. It's a problem in UAW-organized automobile plants with, you know, probably the highest-paid blue-collar workers and the best-protected blue-collar workers in the United States. It's a problem for call centers. We now have something like 6 million people working in telemarketing call centers where there very frequently are very strict rules about getting up and going to the bathroom. It's a problem for, believe it or not, for pharmacists. Many pharmacists work in alone in places, in a pharmacy in places like Walmart, very long shifts. It's not unusual at all to work 12, 13-hour shifts in pharmacies, and in many instances, they're never allowed to leave at all for anything, not for rest, not to eat, not to go to the bathroom.
Well, we're just about out of time, but I think you have an offer for the listeners.
Yes. Special offer, special opportunity for your listeners. If any of you are interested in either of these two books on bathroom breaks or on either of the two books on overtime, you can email me at Mark, M-A-R-C, hyphen, not underline, Linder, L-I-N-D-E-R, at UIowa, U-I-O-W-A dot E-D-U. And just in one sentence, tell me why you're interested in the subject matter, give me your mailing address, and I'll send you the books.
All right.
Free.
That's email mark-linder at uiowa.edu. And I'll repeat that after the break. Thanks for joining us,
Thank
Mark
you.
Linder. Mark Linder, author of many books on work time and the right to pee on the job, among many other things. Professor of labor law at the University of Iowa. And we'll be back after this word from Patty Smith.
Job in a factory inspecting pipes. 40 hours, $36 a week, but it's a paycheck, Jack. So hot in here, hot like Sahara. You can faint in the heat, he's just too lame to understand. Too goddamn grateful to get this job, to know they're getting screwed up. All these women that got no teeth, and gum or cranium, and the way they set hot sausage for me, well, I wasn't saying too much neither. I was more a schoolgirl, hard-working ass. I figured I was a speedo motorcycle, I had to earn my dough, had to earn my dough. But no, you gotta relate, right? You gotta find the rhythm within. The floor boss slides up to me and he says, hey, sister, you're just moving too fast. You're screwing up the quota. You're doing your piecework too fast. Let me get off your Mustang, Sally. You ain't going nowhere. You ain't going nowhere. I lay back. I get my nerve up. I take a sweet aroma alarm. I walk up the hot dog hook and I say, hey, fix this joint. It don't matter whether I do labor fast or slow. There's always more labor after. She's real Catholic, see? She fingers her cross and she says, there's one reason. There's one reason. You do it my way or I push your face in. We need you in the jive if you don't get off your Mustang, Sally. If you don't shake it up, baby. Shake it up, baby. Twist and shout. Oh, what I could do, lady over here. James Brown saying I love someone.
was Patti Smith from her 1975 single, Piss Factory. I think we can say that word on the air, but there are many other words in that song that we can't say on the air, so I had to bleep them out. But it's a great, great, great song, even if it does show a somewhat disturbing lack of working class solidarity. And the show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM on your radio dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And as I say every week, be sure to check out that website. Lots of good stuff on there about the station, but also lots of other things, the outside world as well. So always worth checking frequently, WBAI.org. And also you can hear us there, of course, if you'd like to listen when you're not in it. The New York metropolitan area and the range of our signal. And now we're joined in the studio by Chris Carlson, who is a writer and a graphic designer, and he's in town. We'll be at Bloom. Blue Stockings Books tonight. Blue Stockings is a bookstore at 172 Allen Street, just below Houston, I believe.
Mm-hmm, one block.
One block below Houston, Lower East Side of Manhattan. It's at 7 p.m.
You're right
there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're here to talk about Critical Mass, mm-hmm. and a film about Critical Mass.
Yeah, there's
so give us who is Critical Mass for those of us who don't know.
Well, obviously, Critical Mass is an expression used in the English language for many things these days, but it has become somewhat known as the rubric under which defiant bicyclists celebrate. So that's the title of our book: is Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration.
So. Bicycling in many ways is a solitary pursuit. People just sort of bicycle alone. Mm-hmm. Even if you're bicycling with a friend, you can't really talk very well. What do bikers do when they get together and get political? What gets them excited?
That sense of isolation actually is what gave rise to the event, which is something that has started in San Francisco in 92 and has since spread all over the world to over 300 cities, more or less on its own, through word of mouth, through eventually the internet became a big part of it. And you have this phenomenon. Anybody who's a daily commuter on a bicycle is familiar with the experience of being completely isolated on the streets of our cities. And really in jeopardy for your life. And it's a fairly ironic thing that you're out driving along on a bicycle and you're actually doing humanity a favor because you're not clogging the streets with cars, you're not polluting, you're creating a more convivial urban atmosphere, et cetera, et cetera. And yet you're actually penalized for that experience by, being threatened with death at every turn and nobody pays any attention to you and they're mad at you. They think you should be on the sidewalk, even though legally you're not allowed to ride on a sidewalk either. Et cetera, et cetera. So the need for socialization, if you will, or social experience out of the bicycling phenomenon was part of what gave rise to Critical Mass, is a sense that why be isolated when really a lot of us are making this intelligent decision every day? Why don't we do it together once a month as a starting point and in so doing become traffic, displace cars from the roads, and actually create something magical and new in the urban environment?
So what are these monthly events? What are they, last Friday?
Last Friday of the month? Pretty much the sun never sets on Critical Mass.
And these happen around the world?
Around the world, pretty much. Yeah, I mean, there's been rides in India, in Pune, and Mumbai, and then you got places in the Middle East, even in Israel, there's several rides. You have Italy now has 23 rides. England had around 18 or 20 at the peak. I think they've diminished a little bit since then. All over Europe, some places in South America have them. All over in Japan, many cities have them now, in Korea. So it's kind of amazing. I mean, who would have thought? But on the other hand, why not? It's an experience that's kind of based on the daily life that people already have. It's not a real big departure to imagine, well, why don't we have this organized coincidence and just get together once a month and ride home together?
Well, what's the point? Is this an advertisement? A bit of civil disobedience? What's
well,
this,
I would say that the beauty of Critical Mass is that it's easily defined in almost any way you want by those who are participating in it. There are no rules of order. There's nobody who's in charge. There's not an overarching definition of what it is. The experience is reducible to a mere bike ride. You could say that's all it is. And for some people, that is, in fact, all it is. They show up. They're looking for a new girlfriend or boyfriend, and it's a fun time to get together with a lot of other people on a bicycle in the streets of the city and actually have a safe experience of riding in a big crowd and talking and making music and laughing and tinkling your bells and smelling the city as it's supposed to be, as opposed to how it is when it's full of pollution. And the auditory pollution, especially here in New York, is quite extreme. And so suddenly you're in an area in the city where it sounds so different. So you have this this chance to just do that at a minimum point. But on a maximum point, you can start talking about re-inhabiting the urban environment, actually beginning to create the public space that we are so lacking, that the market has done so much to privatize and eliminate from our lives. Here we are taking over the streets that have been essentially given away to the car companies and the oil companies and say, here, you guys can just wreck our lives and have a full run of the place. And we're saying, no. You know, on the contrary, we actually have a better idea of something else to do with the same space. And by just doing it, not waiting for permission, not asking anybody to give us a permit or surround us with their authorities or anything like that, we just go out and fill the streets with bikes. And then people who see it go by in general are really supportive because they see that this is about what a city could be like. It's not waiting for somebody to do it for you. It's doing it.
How do the men and women in blue react to these things?
Well, there's a long history to that at this point because we've been going for over a decade. San Francisco's already passed its 10th birthday, and New York's has its own history with the police as well, and every city does. And it tends to be specific from city to city, but certain patterns repeat. And I'm quite sure the police are talking to each other across city boundaries because there's interesting patterns that have developed. So you get a period of time in which, first of all, they don't know that you're doing it. And they don't really do anything. They might show up and kind of scratch their head and wonder, what could this be? There's, 100 or 300 bicycles going by, but it goes so quickly, it doesn't bother anybody. When you start getting into the thousands of bicycles and you get to 20 minutes to 40-minute delays and gridlock in major city areas, that tends to freak out the authorities, and they think that this is out of control and it should be controlled. But then they find out it's an elephant, and they can't do anything except help it move along.
I was in San Francisco a few years ago when I guess it had reached a boiling point. A lot of angry motorists and politicians were making noises about cracking down.
Was that in 97?
I guess that was about 97.
Well, there's a famous police riot in 1997 in which the Mayor Brown, who's got a real ego issue for himself anyway, had been briefly delayed during the June ride in his limousine. The guy gets around, he's a public servant, drives everywhere in a limousine with a driver. And decided that he'd been delayed 10 or 20 minutes and said, just ridiculous, and how dare anybody get in his way, the imperial president or imperial mayor that he is. And just started making a lot of noise during the summer news lull about, I'm going to crack down on these out-of-control bicyclists. This is an outrage. They're not obeying the law, and da-da-da-da-da. And so by the time it rolled around, there'd been a whole series of sort of fake negotiations with people who don't represent anybody, because in fact nobody can represent critical mass. That's part of the resilience of it, is that the city bureaucracies of the United States or anywhere else generally have nobody to negotiate with. There's nobody to go and say, come into a meeting and make a deal with me and I'll give you this and then you're going to stop doing all these other things. So in fact, critical mass remains quite uncontrolled and quite free thanks to that lack of a hierarchy and lack of any kind of formal leadership. So there was a series of people who went into meetings with Brown and came out, and at a certain point it was like Neville Chamberlain walking out of a room saying, we've got a deal. And so then the police announced what our route would be and where we would go and when we would leave and did this whole thing, and everybody just basically thumbed their nose at it, and it was chaos. And you had like 5,000 bicyclists because everybody had heard, this is it, big confrontation. So thousands of people showed up, who many of whom had never been on the ride before. And it was complete chaos in the streets, but in a fun way. I mean, for those of us that have been doing it all along and continue to do it after that, the July 97 ride was extremely fun. It was exuberant. We were just like, the streets were full of bikes in every direction. Everybody was laughing and chatting. And there's all these different groups splitting off and going in different directions. Then the police got more and more irritated. Of course, they're being shown up by this because of their whole ego trip of, control. So and Brown basically unleashed them and said, go ahead and attack. And so they did. They took a one spot. We have it on videotape. It's in the documentary that I'll be showing tonight called We Are Traffic by Ted White. And there's this one scene where there's this group of, like a platoon of police who just surround a bunch of bicyclists who are completely doing nothing. They're standing on the street and just start wailing on them and throwing people to the ground. And they've got one shot that we've used as a still of this huge, burly, 6-foot-something cop on a 5-foot woman with his knee on her neck and her hands bound behind her back. She had done absolutely nothing. I mean, there's all this documentary evidence. She'd done nothing. But, they were showing that they had a role to play, which was to enforce the state's authority over the bicyclists, over the few they could corral. Later that night, they managed to surround the remnant of the ride, which was down to about 110 people, and arrested them all, and then claimed there had been these mass arrests, and then, of course, the media working hand in glove with them at that point. had headline news the next morning, 250 arrests. Well, there was actually only about 107 arrests. They couldn't even get the facts straight, and it was blown up into this huge storm, and it just kind of blew over. It was, as many of us who've been around politics for a while in the United States and in San Francisco in particular knew, this was a tempest in a teapot, and it would soon pass, and there was no diminishing of our presence on the streets. The next month, we showed up several thousand strong again. And at that point, just to kind of play with the whole phenomenon of it, we went completely by the book. We did the good shoulder soldier strike routine. So you just absolutely follow every rule, which is a much bigger mess.
I'm speaking with Chris Carlson, who is a writer, graphic designer in town, for an appearance tonight at Blue Stockings Bookstore at 172 Allen Street, in the Lower East Side, block below Heston. And he'll be reading from a book and showing a film. What, and the book again?
It's called Critical Mass, Bicycling's Defiant Celebration, published by AK Press.
Now, of course, it's not just about fun. There is some political content, at least for some of the people involved in it. And it's a battle over urban turf and the kind of city that we want to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So what's that angle?
Well, obviously, the design of cities is not something that we have much control over. There's these really elaborate bureaucracies who are more responsive to large blocks of money and capital than they are to individual citizens. People's desire for more pedestrian safety, bicycle safety, ways to be in the cities that aren't just about buying and selling and moving from cash transaction point to cash transaction point are just not even on the agenda for most urban planners and bureaucrats. Although, to be honest, I think that tide is turning a little bit. There's a lot of people associated with the bicycling movement, primarily in the mainstream advocacy organizations, who are very interested in and very involved with, including here in New York, urban planning issues, and get real involved in the process and are trying to alter that. And actually having this sort of uncontrollable mass seizure of the streets month after month gives them credibility, gives them actually some political muscle, whereas if they were just showing up as you know, do-gooders in these meetings, they don't get much of a hearing unless there's some political punch behind them. So that's part of it, is that kind of vision of an alternative or radically transformed, if you will, urban experience, urban environment, something that we would actually begin to have some kind of actual democracy over deciding, you know, science and technology someday even. I mean, that's where I go with it. I go much further than just the question of should we have a wider street or a narrower street, bigger sidewalks or nicer flower boxes. All those are nice questions if you live in that particular spot. But the deeper issue has to do with some kind of more thoroughgoing democratic life. And in this country, and I think worldwide, the dictatorship of the market and the logic of the marketplace in which we ourselves are reduced to commodities and everything we are involved with is subject to buying and selling, including ourselves, is precisely the problem. And what we need, in my opinion, to have is some way of actually exercising control over the big decisions of science and technology and research and development and what kind of a world do we want to live in. What kind of technologies might enhance our humanity and enhance our ability to live together in complex societies? We don't even get to have that conversation, let alone actually exercise some genuine political power over those kinds of questions.
Well, yeah, let's talk a bit about that, then, because we were speaking about this the other night over on the lovely Allstate Cafe on the Upper West Side.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain kinds of political activists, radicals, anarchists, whatever, who are very anti-technology.
True.
And who would be happy to go back to the hunter-gatherer stage.
Well,
you're not one of those.
I'm not one of those. No,
what's your position?
Well, I'm enthused about complex human societies. I'm not in favor of radical mass murder, reduction of the population of the planet. I think we need to figure it out. And I actually think there's plenty of everything for everybody. It's not really an issue about whether we could do it. It's possible. The question is, of course, people are going to argue, oh, the carrying capacity of the planet, or there's all these kinds of eco arguments that are really just, I think, thinly guised arguments for issues of sort of Malthusian sensibilities in which there's too many of those people, whoever that's not in your category. You know, they don't wear your shoes or eat your food. They're immediately the other. So I think that a lot of the sort of neo-primitivists tend to fall into the camp, whether they like it or not, of people who otherize a huge part of the population, who just write them off as not worthy of, you know, trying to work it out with. And my issue with what I do politically around critical mass and all of these deeper issues of technology is to look at people who aren't like me and realize that I've got to work it out with them. Precisely, it's the people who I feel least comfortable with, who are the ones driving those SUVs and living in the suburbs, they're the ones that we have to have some kind of a dialogue with and begin to transform the world with. And if we can't figure that out, you know, on some deeper moment down the road, how are we going to change the world? I mean, these are just the people we live nearby here. Then there's, of course, the incredible disparities of wealth and poverty throughout the planet, much more grinding and everywhere else than here, although bad enough here. And, you know, we have to figure out how to actually live together and share the wealth. And this, to me, there's plenty of food. There's plenty of the chance for shelter, good homes for everyone. Everything you need could be provided if that was the point of life. I mean, my favorite tagline on this is to say, look, if it was the point of our lives, we could do this. We could live a lot better. We could have a lot more fun, and we could work a lot less. If that was the point of life, if we decided this is our goal, this is what we're going to get to, and we're going to use technologies to get us there where they're not oppressive to the individuals who are at work, where they aren't ruining the ecology of the planet, where they're actually enhancing our humanity and our creativity, then this will actually make this possible. But we have to actually share that social goal, right? And I feel like I'm like, you know, whistling in the wind when I bring that kind of stuff up. I go, oh, that's crazy. We'll never change the world like that. I actually think we're really close to the possibility of it all the time. Like every day we get up in the morning and we go back and we make this mess. Well, why not get up in the morning and go and make the world we want to live in?
Yeah, we've had a tremendous increase in the productivity. You know, certainly we heard a lot about the productivity revolution in the late 90s, but looking at the long sweep of history, productivity has increased enormously.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking earlier about the length of the workday. We're not working a five-hour week yet. That, to me, like, that's what we should be talking about, is working a radically reduced work week, sharing the necessary labor, and that begs the question of what's necessary. Most of the work we do is a waste of time. Nobody should do it. Banking, real estate, insurance, advertising. I mean, it's just like this whole industries. Get rid of them tomorrow.
That's all about extracting the value from the work that other people do and accumulating it for a privileged elite.
Passing it around, for the few.
Yeah. But as you were saying the other night, you're optimistic, and that's certainly not my temperamental instinct. And, there's certainly enough fuel for pessimism when you look around the world.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the realistic position...
Say something encouraging for us.
The realistic position is pessimistic because the facts are horrible for the most part, but... I have a lot of faith in the resilience of the human spirit, and I actually think that people all the time, no matter how little we can put our... Like, I think one of the problems is that if you're involved with any kind of tradition of the left, there's a tendency to identify social movements and change with certain kinds of behaviors, like aggregating into organizations and waving signs and putting pressure on authorities. And those are real things to do. I don't want to totally denigrate them, although I don't think they necessarily do very much these days except reproduce, you know, our own marginality and the structure of power as it exists. I think that people in general are oftentimes, not always and not everybody, but many, many people, probably a majority, have self-emancipatory behaviors that they are involved in, whether they go and can maintain a community garden, whether they're decided to be a bicyclist, whether they've gotten intrigued by, biodiesel. Maybe they're involved in helping doing support on some kind of open source software project. There's all these ways that people take their labor, their time, and their technological know-how out of the marketplace all the time. And one of the necessities of the system is to keep stopping that process and bringing it back into the process of buying and selling. So every time you take your time and labor and energy and know-how and good energy, good spirit towards other human beings out of the marketplace and do something as a gift or as a gesture of goodwill to your fellow citizens and neighbors, etc., you're subverting the larger dynamic of the society. And that's what happens all the time. People cooperate naturally, and the system forces them into these ridiculous competitive and parasitical relationships with each other. So I think, you know, if we begin to sort of put our finger all the time on our own chances, it's a chance. You know, you always have these opportunities. Could I do something generous here, or should I do something that's self-interested? And the more we can act generously in the moments, and nobody can do it all the time. I'm not asking anybody to be a saint. Like, I am not a saint. Far from it. But it just seems to me to be possible. And it's certainly something that I take hope in, because I think there's a lot of incipient behaviors, like I call them, incipient self-emancipatory prefigurative behaviors that people are involved in, whether it's involved with this outlaw bike culture or gardening, all these things that I mentioned, where they're not only removing themselves at a moment from the cash nexus, but they're also actually doing something that's a practical skill that begins to create and enact the world that we want to live in. And so who knows where that starts to go? The more that people find the trust with each other in those communities, the more they can have a vision of something radically different. And critical mass is an example of creating a space that's in motion going through an urban environment that begins to really change people's imagination about what's possible. And that's incalculable.
Now, there's an Utney Reader-ish version of this sort of thing where it's if you just do the right soulful mode of consumption.
Yeah. I'd like to say you can't shop your way to revolution. There's nothing you can buy that's going to make any difference at all.
They're talking about if you buy the right herbal tea or
it's
buy a degradable detergent.
It's just simply
so how do you differentiate what you're talking about from what they're talking about?
Okay. Well, I'm talking about what you do, and it's not about what you buy. Okay, there's a bunch of behaviors that you can be involved in that are actually creative behaviors that are creating spaces, that are creating technological applications about things you're doing in the world that aren't about going to a store and buying something. They're very specifically outside of the marketplace. So I think that there may be aspects of that list of Utney Reader-ish stuff, which I also kind of roll my eyes about a lot of that. But nevertheless, if somebody's involved in, say, creating some kind of herbal remedies, and then sharing them in their community of friends as one of their ways of participating. They grow it in their garden. They say, here's the tea you need for your little illness. I've learned how to deal with these herbal remedies. That's great. That's that kind of direct cooperative connection that we hope for, that we need more of, that the society will be overthrown by someday. But the stuff where you go and you buy this, you know, really expensive bottle of pills that some manufacturer made wherever they made it, and brought it to that health food store, and the health food store is paying minimum wage to their workers, and somebody's rate. I mean, it's just like, obviously that reproduces the system. It doesn't undercut it. So what I'm thinking about are all the behaviors that undercut that logic of buying and selling and market life.
All right, and for more, people can hear it at Blue Stockings Books tonight, 172 Allen Street, Lower East Side of Manhattan, just below Houston Street. And for further information about Blue Stockings, you can see their website, bluestockings.com, or they can call 212-777-6028.
I wanted to make one more pitch, too, which is that this Blue Stockings event tonight is part of Bike Summer 2003, which is being hosted by Times Up here in New York, and they're a fantastic organization. They need a lot of support, a lot of engagement. People are doing a lot of volunteer work with them already, but they need more. And everybody should get their bicycles and turn out for tomorrow night's Critical Mass, which meets at Union Square North at 7 p.m. And we're going to the Socrates Sculpture Garden for a wonderful after party, so it'll be quite an experience. You don't want to miss it. Be sure to come with your bike.
That's Union Square tomorrow?
Union Square North at 7 p.m. Friday night.
Thanks for joining us, Chris Carlson.
My pleasure.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this classic electronica from the 1970s, Kraftwerk's Autobahn.
Operations in progress, or given order in this global war.